Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday, March 19th, 2024 episode of the musical universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is saxophonist, composer, and arranger Anton Deleka. Deleka is a saxophonist and composer and dog lover from Melbourne, Australia. He has led bands for over 25 years and has recently released his fifth album, The Offering. In late 2019, Deleka returned from living in New York for 2 years, where he completed a master's in music and jazz studies at the Aaron Copland School of Music at Queen's College. Over the years, he has played with some American greats, including Arthur Blythe, Odeon Pope, Wycliffe Gordon, and Maceo Parker in a performance at the 2018 Melbourne International Jazz Festival. He performed for 13 years with the Bamboos, recording 9 albums and many spin-off projects. Deleka studied saxophone with Dave Liebman, Chris Potter, George Garzon, Antonio Hart, Tim Armacost, Rich Perry, Joel Fromm, and Dana Stevens, and studied harmony with David Berkman and composition and arranging with Dennis Mackerel and Michael Philip Mossman. He holds a Bachelor of Arts in Improvisation from the Victorian College of the Arts, a Bachelor of Arts Honors in Multimedia Design from Swinburne University, and a Master in Music from Queen's College, New York City. Deleka has taught music in various settings for many years, and in 2018 to 2019 was a mentor educator at the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Corona, Queens. He lectures in music and tutors saxophone at the Australian College of the Arts, and he tutors saxophone and leads ensembles at Scotch College, Melbourne. Deleka is a DiArtio woodwinds artist and endorses Sios mouthpieces. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Anton Deleka. Hello, Anton.
Hi, Craig. How's it going?
It's going great, and it's super to have an opportunity to speak with you. And for my listeners, it's a little bit after 11 p.m. where I am, and Anton is down under in Australia. Not even afternoon yet. It's not even lunchtime yet, I guess.
What time is it? It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, you're 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Man, have I got it all mixed
four
up.
4 o'clock
so
in the afternoon.
It's almost happy hour. All right. Well, that's good. That's good. But
yeah.
We're really been looking forward to the opportunity to talk with you and find out more about you and have you talk about us about jazz in Australia. But I always like to start with what I kind of call everyone's origin story. And what I'm curious to know is who turned the light on for you in terms of music?
Oh, that's a great question, actually. I grew up in a family of musicians. So my dad played a bit of button accordion, like a folk musician. Mum was a classical pianist and singer. My sister, who passed away when I was young, she played cello and piano. And my brother was a song and dance man. Still does music theatre. There was a lot of that. I will say though, and I remember I'd heard this question before, and for me it was in those early teen years when I'd started listening, became obsessed with music, you know, like listening to music. Mm-hmm. You know, like I played piano and I played various instruments, bit of violin, bit of drums. I played serious drums. I was a Scottish pipe band drummer, but it was Blondie, it was Tom Scott on Auto American, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show, the sax player and that, you know, those kind of things. Like I've got to say, like Blondie, the Auto American album with the, you know, what Tom Scott did with those saxophones on that record, you know, it's pretty incredible. There was a jazz tune on that Deborah Harry sang, and it was masterful, great from everyone, you know. So there was that stuff. And then so I was obsessed with music young, like early teens. And then a little bit later, I got the opportunity to see the great Australian musician James Morrison with his big band. And that just blew my mind. I loved James Morrison, and I also loved Don Burrows, who was another great Australian multi-instrumentalist, equally as good on clarinet, flute, and saxophone. He could play oboe, he could play anything. So Don Burrows, James Morrison. And then also there was a time when I got to hear a great classical saxophone quartet called the Peter Clinch Quartet, which was very famous here, and they did tour internationally. And I just never heard saxophone played in that way before. Mm-hmm. That was when I was in about year 10, I think. So about 15 or 16, it was a little concert in a small town, and they, you know, came in from the big city. They picked up their saxophones, got them out of their cases, sat down and just hit it, you know. So there are a few key elements, but for me, Don Burrows and James Morrison are key figures, you know. And but hearing James Morrison's big band was absolutely mind-blowing for me, you know, as a kid.
I seem to remember my introduction to James Morrison was when I was in graduate school. I think I was working on my master's degree, and I was studying studying jazz improv with Rich Madison, who is a wonderful jazz euphonium and tuba player. And Rich brought in a recording of James Morrison, and he said, "This guy, you won't believe, he plays all the trumpet parts, all the trombone parts, all the sax parts." I think the only thing he didn't play was bass and drums, you know, on this particular album.
Oh, no, he plays bass and drums.
Well, does he? Maybe he plays
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, he plays very good bass and drums. Yeah.
you know, and listening to that and just being totally blown away and amazed that one person could play all the instruments and come across. Yeah. And, of course, subsequent to that, I've seen a lot of online recordings and things with him playing, and just an amazing musician. I can see how he would be impactful in terms of yourself, and and it's great that, you know, we have the particular artists that kind of, like, say, turn the light on for us and really get us attracted to the music and get us hooked on it. So, well, you know,
we were lucky in Australia because Don Burrows had a television show. In Australia in the 80s, jazz was quite prominent in the media. And so, you know, I think I was lucky to come up in that period when jazz had a real place in the mainstream Australian media, which it does not now. It doesn't have any place. That you never see jazz in Australia. It's become very parochial in that kind of way. Sports, primarily sport here. There are arts. There's a lot of rich arts happening, but you don't see a lot on the in the media. So I was lucky. Don Burrows had a television show. He'd play Dexter Gordon. He'd play all the greats, Miles Davis, who play everyone, you know. So yeah, that was cool, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm curious. I didn't include this in my original questions, but I think I would be remiss if I didn't have you just talk a bit about jazz in Australia and you know, how the scene has been and where it is now. And to inform my listeners about jazz in Australia.
I think the level here is these days is extremely high. There were always stars or great musicians like, you know, Don Burrows, James Morrison, George Gollar, those kind of people, guitarist George Gollar, but now there are many, you know, musicians who are really an international level. You've got, which is fantastic. And so recent, like when I first went to New York in 2000, really there weren't many Australians there. There was Barney McCall, great piano player, Sean Wayland, and one of my, Dale Barlow, who's one of my heroes. He wasn't there at that time, but he was the big hero of mine, still is, great tenor saxophonist. But, now, recently, when I lived in New York and stayed there for 2 years, Australians are quite well regarded because you've got so many great musicians, you know, from here. You know, many of which have gone to Juilliard or they've gone to Manhattan School and obviously Berkeley, North Texas. You know, many of the major. It's become much more the norm now here to go over and try to get a scholarship at one of the major institutions. So I think the scene is, you know, like it's very thriving. It's very thriving despite the lack of representation in the media. The creative music scene here is very rich. Well, there's a lot going on. Like I find myself engaged really in an enriched way musically every week. So it's really cool, you know. Initially when I came back from the States, I was, you know, I think everyone who has stayed a period of time in New York City, you know, you get this sort of come down, you know, and I was like, oh my God, there's nothing here. And that's not true. There's a lot going on here. And there's the distinct sound, like say for example, Melbourne has maybe you might say more of a European bent to the music, you know, a little less African-American inspired, which is not me. My music is very heavily African-American inspired, gospel orientated, funk orient, you know. Sydney is more in the traditional bebop. This is a massive generalization, but Sydney tends to be a little bit more in that bebop way, and Perth is just overall an excellent music scene from what I've heard. And you know, some of the musicians that have come out of there are incredible. Matt Chodrell, the trumpeter, he went to Juilliard and stayed in New York for 10 years and he's recently moved back, and there's many other musicians. Yeah, so it's pretty good. I would say it's, you can generally find the people that connect with you. You know, there's enough musicians here to, like, I like as you may have guessed, you know, I like playing big band music, like on like Allington, Thad, that kind of stuff. And I'm lucky I'm in a great band here that's playing that stuff, and we really try to play it really well. And you know, so yeah, there's a lot going on, and obviously original music, lots of original music. So yeah, it's I would say it's pretty thriving.
Well, that's good to know. I think that people I talk to who are in, still in New York or LA, Chicago, they seem to think that post-COVID that a lot of people are starting, because they were hungry to get out and enjoy live music. And so there's some clubs that are, I forget who was telling me about to get into Smalls. The line was going all the way around the block, just to get
Oh
in.
man, Smalls is hilarious. Like even when I was there this time around, and I remember Smalls from 2000, but Smalls, when it, you know, yeah, Smalls, I don't even think it had a bar at that time, if I remember. You could bring BYO alcohol. But yeah, Smalls is hectic. But I still like, I find I love Smalls. I love it. You know, I mean, everyone loves Smalls. The only thing I did notice in is that there's more touristy kind of types talking loudly, which I can't stand because I go to listen to the music.
I'm right there
And
with you.
I remember that in 2000, I used to go see Sam Yael's trio every Wednesday night with, I think it was Scott Colley and it was Brian Blade on the drums. And then, you know, one night Josh Redman dropped in, you know, and I'm just like, my mind is just, because I love Josh Redman, you know, and I'm just like, this is unbelievable. And everyone's super quiet, you know. Now it's a bit more rowdy.
Well, it's interesting. I remember there was we had a club here in Milwaukee that for a while, and they had they very they had signage up in the club that please to not talk, certainly no cell phone, anything like that, when the musicians were performing. And I know there's been places and they won't serve while the band is playing. So they'll come on and make an announcement, to get your drink order in, because once the band starts playing, they won't serve. And then they actually were shushing people if they would talk, which of course I was all for. I thought that was fine. But that club no longer exists. It just seems like at least in Milwaukee, we've kind of starting to run short of jazz clubs. We had another great club, the Jazz Estate, which probably about 6, 7 months ago now, just decided they weren't going to offer live music anymore. They couldn't afford it, they said.
Ah, oh, such a
So
shame.
always
Such a
trying to
shame.
find so trying to find places to play is getting more challenging. And then there's been some clubs in New York that have closed. 55
Cornelia Street,
Bar.
they had 55 and the Jazz Standard.
So
Great club. All great clubs.
yeah,
Great clubs.
and so there's that. And then I was talking to a guy last week. I was interviewing a bass player, Dave Barron, and he seemed to tell me that when I asked him the big challenges. Well, of course, streaming services aren't doing any artists any favors.
Oh my God.
And then
I mean, I don't know about you, but I make nothing from the streaming.
no. I put out an album. I put
As
out
a
an
jazz
album.
musician, you know.
Yeah, I put out an album like 4 years ago. I'm still waiting for my first $20 check. But that, and then the course, the newest boogeyman on the horizon is artificial intelligence. And a
AI,
lot
of
of people
course,
are
yeah.
kind of concerned about what's going to happen there. But it sounds to me like the jazz is thriving because there's a large enough community that supports each other and kind of keeps that going. I think that that's not uncommon in a lot of places, including New York, when I talk about that.
I mean, New York is, It seemed, I mean, when I was there, New York, the jazz clubs were packed, and the jazz clubs here, it's can be hit and miss, but often there's three main jazz clubs in Melbourne: the Jazz Lab, Uptown Jazz Cafe, and the Paris Cat. They're all great clubs, and they're fantastic. And the last few times I've played at the Jazz Lab, it's been packed. Packed, people come out, they love the music,
Sure.
and no one needs to shush anyone.
That's
It used to be
wonderful.
like that in that club, but it's not like that anymore. So it's pretty happening. But of course, I don't make much money from the jazz. I mean, yeah, I play the gigs. That's why I do the teaching to support my jazz addiction, or
Well, I
my,
had
you
a,
know, yeah.
I mean, I've had, I've, I don't know, I had, I had an interview this morning, with a wonderful pianist, composer, arranger, band leader, and she was, she's also on the faculty at State University New York Purchase. She's an adjunct
Oh, she's
faculty
a
there.
purchase.
I'm,
Yeah, because I
yeah.
went to Queen's College, which was
Oh,
just a
okay.
fantastic
Yeah.
program. Just
And
fantastic. Loved it so much.
I interviewed Andrew Hadro, who's a Barry and bass
Right.
saxophonist, and he when I
Yeah.
did his interview, I talked to him from his office at Van Doren. He works for Van Doren Reeds on the side, and he was
Good
telling me, he says,
gig, man.
yep, he said, I he told me, he said, I don't know a single musician in New York that doesn't have some kind of side hustle going.
You got to have a side hustle.
Teaching or working in the industry in some way or whatnot. So I guess that's just the realities anymore. I mean, I kind of came at it,
It's yeah.
I kind of came at it backwards. I went into it as an educator, but I got into higher education, which allowed me the opportunity to have the freedom to play when I wanted to. And now that I'm
Yeah, higher
semi-retired,
education's great.
now that I'm semi-retired, I play all I want to. I mean, it's just,
Yeah, that
easy.
I think for jazz musicians, retirement is the goal, because you can you don't have the day gig holding you down,
Yeah, that's true.
and you
Yeah,
can
you
play.
don't.
A friend of mine has just quit finally all of his sort of teaching responsibilities, and he is loving life. He owns a home. He's secure financially. He's older than myself. And he's just, all he's doing is playing and getting into all the gigs he's doing, and he's just having a ball. He's having a great time. It's, and I wanted to say, in I had a strange experience, like many in the world would have had this kind of thing, where I was in a quite a successful band for several years, like 13 years. I was in this. We did a lot of touring and a lot of playing, and it's not like I became rich from the band, but I certainly made, a certain income from the band. So I did not need to do the teaching particularly, and I would do my jazz gigs. I would do that band, and I kind of I had to make the call. That feeling sometimes where you just feel you're stagnating, and you just. I had all the great gigs in Australia. I was touring and all sorts of things, but I just was like, I really need to get back to the States. I want to study from, I just want to study from the best people, and play, and I had to do that. So I had to leave that band, and I've my jazz playing has improved greatly. Certainly the education I received at Queen's College. I learned from Antonio Hart, Tim Armacost, was fantastic. And so it was worth it, but it does mean that I need to teach more now, because I'm not doing the touring and the those kind of bigger shows, you know what I mean? So, and that's the trade-off. That's the trade-off.
Well, I
Yeah.
mean, it's what we do to be able to do what we love. That's the bottom line,
That's it,
Yeah.
because
Well, I'd like to shift gears for just a little bit and talk about you as an artist. And one of the things I used to tell my students when I taught both music appreciation and also jazz history is that music is painting with sound on a canvas of silence. And my question
Beautiful.
for you is, would you talk about your various approaches to the elements of music as a performer or a composer? You can begin to talk about that as well, that you take to create different colors and forms of expression.
It's a fantastic question. I mean, for me, it's got to come from that. Clearly, there has to be technique. So I consistently practice technique, like most of us do, I guess. Then there's the craft of knowing what material you're playing so well that you don't need to think about it, as you would know too. You know, this is when I'm playing with my group, and then I'm free. And that freedom allows for the creativity to flow. I'm obsessed at the moment with flow state. So if I'm not in flow, then it's not anything. And music has to have heart for me. It has to have feel and groove, and it's got to have a certain spiritual power. If it doesn't have that, I don't listen to it. It doesn't matter how good it is, I'm not going to listen to it. And I've heard, as many of us have, incredible musicians, you know, young players in New York who can run rings around me on the saxophone or whatever. You know, I mean, they're unbelievable. And yet, some of them don't say anything with their saxophone, so, or their instrument. And so I love people like Rich Perry, Dick Oates, Dana Stevens, Tavon Pennicott, people that obviously, if you're talking the greats, Miles is probably my, you know, favorite all-time musician. You know, when Miles plays a ballad, it comes from another place, you know. So that's what I'm going for. So I try to bring in a state of not knowing, you could say, when you go to play. So if you're playing a piece of music, yes, know the music so well that you're inside out knowing the music. I got that from Kenny Werner and Antonio and just everyone. You know, I mean, any great jazz musician, as you know, knows what they're doing, and then the freedom comes from that, you know. And as far as, so for me, it can't have, because I record every gig I do, and I listen to everything I do, and I obviously listen on the bandstand to everyone during the gig, but it's got to come from a place of flow and soul and heart. If it doesn't have that, I'm not. It's not what I'm going for, and I'm not cool with it. So you know, for example, when I was in the States, I heard Jerry Bergonzi, you know, and I've always loved Jerry Bergonzi's playing, but I felt like I was hearing Picasso on the tenor saxophone. You know what I mean? It was like I felt like I was hearing the heaviest of heavy masters, you know, and it because it came from absolute freedom and absolute just painting colors with the sound. And so that's what I'm going for. But of course, yeah, I'm not Jerry Bergonzi, but
Well,
you
you
do the
know.
best you can with what you have, you
Well,
know.
sure you do, but I think I relate. I think I relate to what you're saying. I'm going to put it in the words of how I feel. I know that when I'm playing, and I'm especially if I'm improvising, There are times when I'll be playing and I know my fingers are moving and I know my lips are buzzing, but I have no idea where the ideas are coming from. It's just like they're coming right out of my subconscious, freely, openly, and I just kind of, it's like almost like I take a step back outside of myself as an observer.
That's
And
exactly it.
it's really hard, and that's not even really an adequate way to describe it. I don't know that I can find the words to describe the experience, but I think from what I hear you saying, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
It's like that thing where you, if I'm in a good flow and everything's working and I've been playing this beautiful Yamaha sax lately. I have an SBA, a super balanced action and blah, 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 blah. But the Yamaha just delivers for me, just has this, everything feels so great on it. And so anyway, the point I was making, I guess, is if you are able to surprise yourself, like I played with one of my dear friends, Kylie Aldous, who's the singer in the band I used to play in, the Bamboos, great band. And I sang, played with Kylie last Saturday night, and I did a solo. Most of the solo was decent. It was cool. But there were a couple of moments, and I was like, oh, holy crap, what's that? I didn't even know. I was like, you've never played that before. I was sort of watching it. And I was like, oh, this is really, and part of it comes from the pressure of the situation, and the level of the band is super high. So you sort of, great musicians push you in a great way into other spaces, and so I look, I it's so funny. You learn from everyone, don't you? Like there's a young guy I've been playing with this big band I've been doing, Oscar Bruton. He's a fantastic young player. He's only 21, and I love his playing, and he's very much in that modern way. The Mark Turner, if you're a saxophone player, you'll know it's the Mark Turner lineage, comes from Frank Tiberi, Warren Marsh, Frank Tiberi, it's that lineage. So he's got all that altissimo thing in that kind of way. I tend to be more the intense altissimo with the screaming train kind of thing. But anyway, the thing that I love about his playing is he's always in flow. Like he won't play anything out of flow, and I don't know if he knows that or if it's just how he is. And I love playing with him because we both play in this big band doing the Thad Jones and whatnot. And I love hearing him play because he's quite surprising, and so I have learned from that. And that's what I've been really focusing on recently. It doesn't matter what your opinion is of it. It's got to come from that space of almost surprise. Oscar will
Well,
play random stuff. You're like, what the hell was that?
yeah, I hear you.
I'm like,
Well, I
that's
mean,
really
and
cool.
there's sometimes, and I think you've alluded to this, that even in our own playing, there's times when I think we sometimes amuse ourselves because it's like, where did that idea come from? And I think those kind of things happen, it's really difficult to put into words to describe what it
It is.
feels like. It's even harder to try to describe it to musically lay people. But it's kind of that experience that I think we have. Well,
But Craig, the thing about it is musically lay people understand this more than we think they do because they know when it's in flow. They
oh,
can
okay. Yeah,
intuit it.
sure.
So I noticed because I recorded the gig on Saturday night when I played this solo, and some of it was neither here nor there. It was some of my shit that I do, excuse me for swearing. But then there were some moments, and I noticed that's when the crowd started, yelling. It was a funky, they yell, and I was like, yeah, they picked up on that, that thing. I just wanted to mention an album I've been listening to, which is just, it's just blown my mind. I love this album, Little Big Two by Aaron Parks. It's his new album. I've always enjoyed his music, but I feel like this record is really next level. Like it's just Okay. something's really happened. And I feel that the whole thing is flow.
Wow.
It's well, flow state, it the out. Whole, from go to woe.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Their first track's in, I think it's 11-8, and you wouldn't know it. You would swear that they're playing in 4-4 just by how natural it feels.
Well, I'll have to check that out. Big, what was it called again? Big yeah. Little Two?
It's called Little Big Two.
Little yeah, Big
that's the
Two.
Second album.
Okay.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, it's a band. They're not the usual characters I would have expected on that record, but they are just, it's just a beautiful record. It's just, when you get those records sometimes and you just find them really inspiring, and that one has really hit a chord for me. Mm-hmm. It's not the usual thing that you hear, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's cool. Well, let's switch gears again just for a sec. And, you know, because you've been focusing on playing and improvising. And I'm also interested in your work as a composer. And have you been doing much writing recently?
Well, it's really funny. I wrote a new album, and I've got the album ready to go. And it's for a quintet. I'm at a point where I need to record the album because at the moment I'm just not inspired to write right now because I want to get it out of my system, if you know what I mean. So
yes, sure.
That's where I'm at. So I usually do write a lot, and I seem to be able to write fairly easily. I don't find it to be difficult. Thing necessarily. I mean, obviously, there's some things I've written that I'm quite happy with. I love harmony. So, you know, Gerald Clayton, for example, is one of my favorite musicians. I love musicians that really know functional harmony and know what to do with it. And obviously I love groove, and a lot of my stuff is groove orientated, but I do love having harmonic movement in my music. It's just one of the things I love doing, you know.
So when you write original work, typically what comes to mind first, a melodic idea, or do you think about chord changes and maybe, you know, what would sound good, and then find a melody that fits that? Or just exactly how does it work for you?
That's such a great question. Look, I am like many people these days, I use my voice memo on my phone. So if I have an idea on the horn, or I sing it, or I play it, if it might be chordal, it might be rhythmic, it could be melodic, it could be both, and I put it into the phone. So at the moment I've got about 100 voice memos with new things that I can discard or look at, or you know, I do the voice memo thing, and then like many people too, I'm guessing, I join things together and go, oh, that thing will work with this thing, maybe this could be the bridge for that. I feel that odd time is still a bit of a weakness for me. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm weak at it anymore, but I do enjoy writing in odd time just for the challenge. And I noticed Antonio Hart mentioned that he would, if he struggles with a certain thing, he'll write a composition in that, you know, key or in that time signature. And I'm the same, I'll do that too. So, you know, if I feel at the moment I'd like to write a piece in 11-8.
Okay.
You know, just because I've been playing a piece in 13-8, and I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on it now. With someone else, for me, it's got to have that natural flow. You know, you want that natural feel. You know, like great New York City players. I just love that thing. You know, like just play it odd time, like it's a walk in the park. You know.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's like I don't know. I don't know. Did you see the motion picture Whiplash? about the young
Oh, of
man.
course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that tune,
Not my tempo.
I think that tune's in 11/8, if I remember right. Hank Levy's Whiplash.
I think it is. I think it might be.
But yeah, that was kind of an interesting
Whose tune is
experience.
that? I can't remember who. That's a famous tune, Whiplash.
Yeah, it's Hank Levy.
Whose tune is that?
Hank Levy.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
Yeah, he was the guy that was writing. He was writing a lot for Stan Kenton back in the 70s. You know, a lot of the odd meter pieces, and of course Don Ellis was kind of coming on the scene in the mid 60s up through 70s, doing a lot of things in very different meters. And so yeah, that was all pretty cool. But yeah, there's something about those like 11/8, and there's a brass quintet piece I have in my book that we play every once in a while. It's by a composer by the name of Rilke, and it's called Dance, and it's like an 11/8, 7/8, it's all over the place. And you know, the best way to play that music is don't try to count. Just feel it. Don't try
Feel.
to count, just feel it. So anyway.
You know, it's so weird, Craig, isn't it? Like I wrote a piece recently that hopefully I'll record soon, and I wrote it quickly, and I found it quite natural to write, and I just came out, and then I wrote, and it turns out it was in 7/8, and I have no issue playing that. I'm good at seven these days; it's fine. But I just noticed, for whatever reason, I feel that piece very easily. Like it's just a dee doo dee doo dee doo dee doo dee doo. So it's got this riff, and you know, I sort of I did an arrangement of Barbara, my last record, in five, and I remember I found that tune fit really nicely into five. You know, that was, and again, quite easy to blow on. Like, and so. You know, as far as writing, I just love music that has some harmonic stuff in there. You know, I love the harmony. You know, like just to, you know, I feel that harmony is one of the greatest things. I just love listening to, you know.
Well, I think that's what, you know, that was part of what made help me fall in love with jazz was seventh chords. You know, I still
As Dick Oates,
remember.
what did Dick Oates say? The great seventh, or he calls it the great seventh chord, or something like that. It's like, you know, it's the most important thing, you
I
know.
mean, I can remember my very first year of beginning band when I was just a little kid, and we in our band book there was this one piece, and it didn't say it was a jazz piece, but it had some harmonies in it that I went, oh, that's really cool. And I think my band director said, yeah, that's what they use a lot in jazz. So anyway, I think harmony is there's a saying that we have. It's a meme that pops up on Facebook a lot. It says rock music, you play three chords for thousands of people. Jazz music, you play thousands of chords for three people, you know.
I know. And look, I love rock music too. I
Oh,
have
I do
nothing in
too.
any way against it. I listen to it all the time. But
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
absolutely.
sometimes I think some people have a hard time grasping the complexities of some of the harmonic language that we use, but it's so rich, it's so expressive. You know, I think in music that has a more limited harmonic language, the expression comes more from the melodic line or the lyric, but in a rich harmonic environment, you get expression from the harmonies. At least that's the way I sense
And
it.
I still feel great musicians can deliver that harmony with groove and feel. You know, Bill Evans, any of the
Oh,
greats, Wynton Kelly or whoever, you know, like Wes, you know, like say for example the Thad stuff we, you know, I played last week, which, you know, the Vanguard Orchestra thing, there's a lot of harmony in there, but there's such deep pocket in the groove that I remember my ex-wife, and she wasn't a jazz person at all, but she loved the Vanguard Orchestra. she loved the Vanguard because it's just such a, it just had that feel, you know. So she didn't know about harmony or any such thing, but she loved the feel of it, the energy, you know, and you know that Mel Lewis fat groove, you know, and people now, Tavon is one of my favorite young tenor players. He's maybe not that young. He might be late 30s or 40 or something. But the thing I love about Tavon, yes, he can hear clusters. He's got incredible ears. He has synesthesia where he sees color, you sound as color, but his pocket is so deep. Like he's got such feel that he delivers it all because it all has this feel to it, you know. I noticed that with that trio I used to see with Sam Yal and Brian Blade. I was like, and I noticed it particularly at that time, and it's still a bit like that. You know, I came from Australia and great play, there are great players here, but there was just something about that feel, that drive when you had Brian Blade in that beautiful way he plays, and that power behind the feel, you know. There's just something in that, you know. And so I really aim for that. I play with a great drummer here, Danny Fisher. He's just a great drummer, you know. He lived over there for years and lived in London. And he's you know, he's like a musical encyclopedia. He knows everything about who played on what. And Danny is that guy. I mean, he just delivers that feel, you know. That's why everyone loves playing with. He's the busiest drummer in Melbourne, you know.
Yeah, I can always. I used to tell people I can. I always love playing with a great drummer because they always will set you up. You don't even have to count your measures rest. You know exactly when to come in.
They set you up so that it's almost like you can't fail because the pocket is so huge. You know, it's like the feel is so powerful that things sit in the pocket. And there's some couple of really good drummers here too. Young guy Ollie Shute, who's been playing with the band. He's a student of Danny. You know, they're sort of it just sets you up to, it's that flow state. You know, you're in the flow state. You're going for that. And it feels like it's easy to make the music. You know what I'm saying? Like
Yes,
I played
yes.
Joshua, you know, that great Miles tune, Joshua with the 3/4 sections in at the Miles tune. Played that with Danny the other night and at speed. And I was like, that three jumping into that 3/4 is quite a thing. And it's 2/5 2 dee do dee da dee. You know, it's 2/5s descending a tone. But it was fine because the groove was so happening. I was like, this just feels great, you know.
Well, it's
And
just it.
obviously, I'd shed. I'd practiced it, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
that's awesome. I mean, it's the kind of thing that we I know we experience, and it's not always easy to put into words to express to people what it's all about. I want to switch gears again, because you're also an educator. And I'd like to hear what you very often advise your students, particularly those that are aspiring to a career in music. And I ask that because I do have a number of younger listeners to my show, and I would like to have them hear what you would advise them about entering into a music career.
That's again a great question. Like I teach young kids and I teach high school kids and I teach uni. So at the uni in that class that I teach, that they're all intending on going into the music industry. I think it's certainly with the older kids, they've already made that decision that they're doing this. I think certainly keeping an open mind is really important. Like, you know, I'm a trained graphic designer. I worked in a rehab over COVID as a support worker. I obviously I do the teaching, but you know, I've had a few different things that I do, and I have So, and there's the financial aspect. So you need to establish how are you going to make a living? You know, there is that nuts and bolts thing. And if you enjoy teaching, then that's a great thing. But if you don't, then think about what you can do. You know what I mean? I know, as we all do, I know scientists and doctors that are great jazz musicians. One of my friend Daniel Gatson is fully trained lawyer. He's not doing that now. He's in Paris, just playing full time. But you know, think about other things. Just keep an open mind about how you can make this work for you. And don't get in that. Some people have this thing, oh, I can't make money out of music. And it's like, that is just absolute rubbish. I know, you know, a couple of my friends are millionaires from music. They've written worldwide hits, you know, that they are songwriters, you know, great songwriters. So if you want, you can make money out of this. It's, you know, it just depends on your headspace. For me, I made a call. I was gonna I'll live in a smaller apartment and I'll play my jazz, have my time for my practice. I've made that call, and that's, I'm very happy with that. That's my decision. You know, I don't need a fancy car. I don't need, I don't, I think it depends on what you feel you need, doesn't it? You know, some people, I need all this crap. It's like, well, for me personally, I'm very happy. You know, I've got a beautiful dog. You know, a bit demanding, but no, she's
Aren't they
lovely.
all?
No, but you know, like, I think you've got to sort of establish where you're at. Like, one
Sure.
thing that has been useful for me is passive income. Like, I have some passive income from royalties, which is very helpful. A little bit of investments. I got lucky. I learned from Mike Mossman. You know, Michael
I
Mossman,
know his I know the
Michael
name.
Philip Mossman.
I don't know him
Yeah.
personally, but I know his name. And I play his
I just
charts.
loved, I just love learning from Mike at Queen's College. He and I took his business class, and I just really enjoyed his perspective on things. And a lot of it was about being open to all sorts of ways of making a living and enjoying yourself. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in music. You know, there's always a way to make a living, and you know, for me, I have to have be artistically fulfilled. If I'm not being artistically fulfilled, I will not do it, because why would I do it? Like, I have to be engaged in music that I find to have meaning. You know, Black American music is important to me. I want to play it. I love it, and it's the best thing that came out of America. In, you know, for me, I think it's the most powerful art form. You know, it has meaning for me. You know, it's, and so if I need to do, you know, a few weddings and do a bit of teaching to be able to do that, then it's fine.
No,
You
I'm
know,
right at Anton. I'm right there with you. I mean, I had an
yeah.
interview, oh, probably 5, 6 weeks ago with a young singer-songwriter in Nashville. And
Yeah.
she really hipped me to a way of thinking that about, you know, being in the music business is really a great way to think about it. She said, you know, not everybody defines success the same way. And if you're able to,
That's
you know,
exactly right.
put a roof over your head and feed yourself and have some, you know, way to meet your needs and be happy, that's successful. Not everybody's going to be a gazillionaire. I mean, that just isn't
No.
reality, you know?
It's, you know, for me, the richness comes in what I do. You know what I mean? I don't care that my car's fine, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't care if I don't drive a BMW. If I'm loving what I do, then I'm cool.
I'm right there with you.
You know?
I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of car you have. It's going to get you the same place. I mean, you're going to get to the same destination whether it's a Ford or a Cadillac. I mean, you know, but
And you know, something came to me, Craig, and this is really important to young people. It just came to me because I used to be really fiery, and over the years I've been, the firecracker. My nickname when I was a kid was spark plug,
Okay.
and the most important thing in music is relationships. That's it. Relationships. So, and unfortunately, I'm old now and I've got experience. I have burnt bridges that I really regret having burnt. Maybe not doing anything that bad, but the relationships are the most important thing. And I learned that later, and I really realized that, it's the people. You play music with people, and so that is the most important, the hang, enjoying being with people. That's the most important stuff. And anytime I've had issues, it's because I haven't been cool. You
No, I hear you. I
know
hear
what
you
I mean?
exactly. I
I've
mean,
been a
there's
dickhead. I've been an
no,
idiot,
I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, there's the greatest satisfaction I have as a musician is getting together with the people I play with and making music together and deriving mutual enjoyment from creating something. Instead of just sucking air, we're actually creating something for other people. And in the relationships that you might have with your audience members, there's nothing to me that's more satisfying than to have a member of my audience say, "Wow, I've never heard music like that before. What do you call that?" And I say, "Well, it's
It's just fantastic.
yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's the human relation. It's the lifestyle that you want to have that defines your success, not some external marker of how many dollars you make and so forth. So I think that's very true. Well,
I
and I
think, you
think
know,
and
really,
I
I just had to point out, like, some of the I've met many of the greatest saxophone players in the world, as many sax players of my age have, Potter, Chris, and George Garzone, and Rich Perry, Tavon, relatively recently. I don't know him very well, but they're all just beautiful people. Melissa Aldana, I'd love to meet one day. I love her playing. And Camilla Thurman, there's many, but if you behave like a wanker, as we say in Australia, it just comes back at you, man.
Sure.
No one wants to be vibed by anyone. It's I you know like, just one quick thing. I had an experience where a few years ago, I was a bit of an idiot in a recording session. I just had a personality clash, and there was some stuff going on. And anyway, and my friend who ran the session said to me, what'd you do, man? And I realized my mistake, and I apologized to the guy, and I apologized to the engineer, and I realized that I'd made a mistake, and I made amends to them. And my friend said such a great thing. He said, that music is a spiritual experience. We're having a spiritual experience. This is a spiritual space. You can't bring your ego in there and be like a bull in a china shop. Like, have that in mind. Say if the bass player is playing the wrong chords, which happened just the other night, the bass player could play completely wrong chords for the form he got lost. And I just had to think, like Miles, Miles just would play, and I did, and it was great. Just let it go, and
Yeah, there's
and
a
we had
lot
a
of
great night. Keep the vibe,
I'm right there with you. Hey, well, speaking of now playing live, you've mentioned some clubs. If I were to be able to magically show up in Melbourne next week, where might I be able to hear you play?
Well, I'm playing at the Jazz Lab, which is my
Okay.
look, it is my favorite club. Sorry, Parascat and Uptown, but I love the Jazz Lab. We're playing there on the
Lab.
17th of March
Okay.
with my quintet, and I'm very excited because I'm getting to play with Brett Williams, who's a He's recently moved here, and he's just an incredible pianist.
Wonderful.
Played with Marcus Miller when he was 17 or something. His history is extensive, but I've heard, I just love his playing, so I'm very excited about that. But I'm always playing. I'm always doing various things. But with
Okay.
my quintet, it's the 17th of March,
Okay.
24 at the Jazz Lab. That's when we're playing in.
Okay, so March
And
17th.
all weekend, and I'm playing a lot at the moment.
Okay. Well, that's
All sorts
good.
of things.
Well, that's good. Well, if I could magically show up, I'd come see you play. And
I
then
wish
you
you
may,
would.
well, I wish I could. You know, I've never been to Australia, so I'd love to do it sometime.
That's great.
Yeah. And then you've got this recording that you're just waiting, chomping at the bit to make. You've got the charts and kind of getting it ready to
You know
go.
how it is, Craig. It's about the cash. I've got to get that
Oh
money
yeah.
to
Oh
put
yeah.
that thing together. You know how it is, you know.
Oh yeah.
So
Stu
I've
studio
got
time's
a my
expensive.
studio. I've got my current album, which I released 3 years ago now, The Offering. That's I still regard that as my current album because it's my most recent. And that's I'm very happy with that record. I recorded that over there in the States with some great musicians and also really good friends. So that, which was a really cool thing. I got Emmanuel Wilkins on that, who I didn't know, but he was beautiful and he's a genius. So he
Oh,
played
cool.
ridiculously well.
Well, that's awesome. That's
This is
awesome.
outrageous.
Well, yeah, well, listen, I only have one more question. I always try to be very thorough in preparing questions for my guests, but I also know that I'm not perfect. And so my last question is there anything else you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
And again, that's another good question. I really, I feel like we've covered a lot of bases. And you know what's going to happen? As soon as we hang up the call, that it'll come to me.
Okay. Well, I'll just let you know.
But no.
I'll let you, just so you know, and just as a reminder to my listeners, I do include in my show notes, your social media information, your website, things like that, so people can, look up and learn more about you. I put usually an example of one of your recorded YouTube performances, things like that. So if we miss something, I'm sure that you'll probably have updated info about what you're doing and where you're going and all that on your website, and
Yeah, man, of
so we
course.
should be
And
good.
thank you for reminding me. I do need to update that
Okay.
info. But
All
my
right.
website is just antondelica.com. And
Yeah.
I frequently post to Instagram. I quite enjoy Instagram, and one of my favorite sort of tenor players who plays with Arturo Sandoval, Mike Tucker, he's always posting to Instagram, and I love his play. Like he's just maybe not, he's not a Wayne Shorter kind of player. He's just a classic great American tenor player. He can play anything, and I sort of do a bit of that. I just put my, if I'm happy with something, I post it to Instagram.
Okay.
So
Well,
there's
that's good.
always new stuff coming up there.
Well, that's a great way for us to all keep up with you. So that's wonderful. Well, Anton, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today, and I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure will be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you so much, Craig. I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate you inviting me on. It's been really enjoyable.
Well, thank you so much. It has been, and you have a good rest of your day.
All right, you too. Thank you so much.
You bet. My discovery composer of the week is Englishman Robert White. Born circa 1538, he died in London in November of 1574. In 1553, the parish of St. Andrews, Holborn, gave young White a payment for ye great organs which his father gave to Ye Church. This almost certainly refers to Robert White, for in 1572, when the Whites were living in Westminster, the instrument was sold by one of the Holborn parishioners to John Thomas and Robert White, probably the composer's father, and installed in the abbey. According to Thomas Wythorn, Mr. White was of Trinity College in Cambridge when he commenced. His name occurs frequently in the college accounts for the period 1555 to 1562, first as a chorister under Thomas Preston, and later as one of the cantors. The University Grace Book of 1542 to 1588 records that White, after 10 years of study, was granted the degree of a Bachelor of Music on December 13, 1560, with the condition that he compose a communion service to be sung at act time the following year in St. Mary the Great's. At Michaelmas 1562, he became master of the choristers at Ely, a post previously held by his father-in-law, Christopher Tye, and remained there until 1566. At Annunciation 1567, a musician named White received a quarterly payment of £4 plus. As master of the choristers of Chester Cathedral, this was Robert White, as supported by Thomas Tompkins' annotated copy of Morley's Plain and Easy Instruction, where Robert White is described as first of Westchester and Westminster. The cathedral accounts and those of the Smiths, Cutlers, and Plumbers of Chester show that the cathedral musicians were actively involved in the Chester mystery plays, and White received particularly generous payments for his services. He probably became master of the choristers at Westminster Abbey shortly before Christmas 1569, but his appointment was not confirmed until February 3, 1570. He died of the plague in 1574, leaving property of some substance in Sussex. Almost half of White's vocal works consist of settings of complete Latin psalms. The texture and structure of seven of these compositions look back to the large-scale votive antiphon of the early 16th century, and three even retain the old division into triple and duple time halves. The remaining five psalm motets are distinguished by continuous full treatment in imitative style. The antiphons and alternatum works are doubtless among the composer's juvenilia. The latter include a Magnificat on the first tone in the florid manner of Taverner, and four settings of the Lenten compline hymn Christe qui lux et dies. However, the responsory Libera Mei, which sets polyphonically the verses as well as the respond, could have been written as late as 1570. The two sets of Lamentations are particularly fine and represent a high point of Elizabethan choral music. In general, White's anthems lack the technical mastery of his motets, and indeed, apart from the adaptations, only one can unequivocally be attributed to him. The instrumental pieces may well date from his youth, compared with Tye's idiomatic and adventurous string compositions. They are straightforward and unremarkable, and may have originated as teaching pieces for the Ely choristers. Despite the limitations of his imitative technique, White's influence on his contemporaries was considerable. His Fantasias, originally for viols, are among the earliest English examples of the genre, and his hymns served as models for two of Byrd's settings of Christe qui lux est. John Baldwin mentioned him in a poem of 1591 as one of the principal musicians of his generation, and Robert Dow, after his copy of the five-part Lamentations in the Dow Part Books, added in Latin, "Not even the words of the gloomy prophet sound so sad as the sad music of my composer." Certainly, both Lamentations and the setting of the Miserere clearly demonstrate White's ability to manipulate large musical structures while at the same time exploiting the expressive potential of the text. The All Music Guide lists 3 recordings of White's chamber music, 10 recordings of his choral music, 8 recordings of music for solo voice with accompaniment, and 5 recordings of what the All Music Guide refers to as miscellaneous music. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube performance of White's Ad Te Le Avi Oculos, performed by Gallicantus. Well, that wraps episode number 181. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I'll be interviewing New York City-based pianist, composer, and arranger Kaylee O'Doherty. Other upcoming interviews include Minneapolis-based jazz singer Leslie Vincent, Nashville-based singer-songwriter Ava Swan, New York City-based jazz singer Nama, Nashville-based singer Lori Triplett, and New York City-based jazz singer and educator Aubrey Johnson. So don't touch that dial. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurst@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.